Penguin Random House Audio presents Shadows on the Rock by Willa Cather. Read for you by Anne-Marie Lee. Vous me demandez des grandes fleurs de ce pays. Nous en faisons venir de France pour notre jardin. N'en ayant pas ici de fort rares, ni de fort belles. Tout y est sauvage. Les fleurs aussi bien que les hommes. Marie de l'Incarnation. Lettre à une de ses sœurs. Québec, le 12 août 1653. Book 1. The Apothecary. Chapter 1. One afternoon late in October of the year 1697, Euclide Auclair, the philosopher-apothecary of Quebec, stood on the top of Cap Diamant, gazing down the broad, empty river far beneath him. Empty, because an hour ago the flash of retreating sails had disappeared behind the green island that splits the St. Lawrence below Quebec, and the last of the summer ships from France had started on her long voyage home. As long as La Bonne Espérance was still in sight, many of Auclair's friends and neighbors had kept him company on the hilltop. But when the last tip of white slid behind the curving shore, they went back to their shops and their kitchens to face the stern realities of life. Now, for 8 months, the French colony on this rock in the north would be entirely cut off from Europe, from the world. This was October. Not a sail would come up that wide waterway before next July. No supplies. Not a cask of wine or a sack of flour. No gunpowder or leather or cloth or iron tools. Not a letter, even. No news of what went on at home. There might be new wars. Floods, conflagrations, epidemics, but the colonists would never know of them until next summer. People sometimes said that if King Louis died, the minister would send word by the English ships that came to New York all winter, and the Dutch traders at Fort Orange would dispatch couriers to Montreal. The apothecary lingered on the hilltop long after his fellow townsmen had gone back to their affairs. For him, this severance from the world grew every year harder to bear. It was a strange thing indeed that a man of his mild and thoughtful disposition, city-bred and most conventional in his habits, should be found on a gray rock in the Canadian wilderness. Cap Diamant, where he stood, was merely the highest ledge of that fortified cliff, which was Quebec. A triangular headland wedged in by the joining of two rivers and girdled about by the greater river as by an encircling arm. Directly under his feet was the French stronghold. Scattered spires and slated roofs flashing in the rich autumnal sunlight. The little capital, which was just then the subject of so much discussion in Europe and the goal of so many fantastic dreams. Auclair thought this rock-set town like nothing so much as one of those little artificial mountains which were made in the churches at home to present a theatric scene of the nativity. Cardboard mountains broken up into cliffs and ledges and hollows to accommodate groups of figures on their way to the manger. Angels and shepherds and horsemen and camels set on peaks, sheltered in grottos, clustered about the base. Divest your mind of oriental color, and you saw here very much such a mountain rock, cunningly built over with churches, convents, fortifications, gardens, following the natural irregularities of the headland on which they stood. Some high, some low, some thrust up on a spur, some nestling in a hollow, some sprawling unevenly along a declivity. The Chateau Saint-Louis, gray stone with steep dormer roofs, on the very edge of the cliff overlooking the river, sat level. But just beside it, the convent and the church of the Récollet friars ran downhill, as if it were sliding backwards. To landward, in a low, well-sheltered spot, lay the convent of the Ursulines. Lower still stood the massive foundation of the Jesuits, facing the cathedral. Immediately behind the cathedral, the cliff ran up sheer again, shot out into a jutting spur, and there, high in the blue air between heaven and earth, rose old Bishop Laval's seminary. Beneath it, the rock fell away in a succession of terraces, like a circular staircase. On one of these was the new bishop's new palace, its gardens on the terrace below. Not one building on the rock was on the same level with any other. And 200 feet below them all was the lower town, crowded along the narrow strip of beach between the river's edge and the perpendicular face of the cliff. The lower town was so directly underneath the upper town that one could stand on the terrace of the Chateau Saint-Louis and throw a stone down into the narrow streets below. These heavy gray buildings, monasteries and churches, steep-pitched and dormered with spires and slated roofs, were roughly Norman Gothic in effect. They were made by people from the north of France who knew no other way of building. The settlement looked like something cut off from one of the ruder towns of Normandy or Brittany and brought over. It was indeed a rude beginning of a new France, of a Saint-Malo or Rouen or Dieppe, anchored here in the ever-changing northern light and weather. At its feet, curving about its base, flowed the mighty St. Lawrence, rolling north toward the purple line of the Laurentian Mountains, toward frowning Cap Tourmente, which rose dark against the soft blue of the October sky. The Ile d'Orléans, out in the middle of the river, was like a hilly map, with downs and fields and pastures lying in folds above the naked treetops. On the opposite shore of the river, just across from the proud rock of Quebec, the black pine forest came down to the water's edge, and on the west, behind the town, the forest stretched no living man knew how far. That was the dead, sealed world of the vegetable kingdom, an uncharted continent choked with interlocking trees, living, dead, half-dead, their roots in bogs and swamps, strangling each other in a slow agony that had lasted for centuries. The forest was suffocation, annihilation. There, European man was quickly swallowed up in silence, distance, mold, black mud, and the stinging swarms of insect life that bred in it. The only avenue of escape was along the river. The river was the one thing that lived, moved, glittered, changed. A highway along which men could travel, taste the sun and open air, feel freedom, join their fellows, reach the open sea, reach the world even. After all, the world still existed, Eau Claire was thinking, as he stood looking up the way by which La Bonne Espérance had gone out only an hour ago. He was not of the proper stuff for a colonist, and he knew it. He was a slender, rather frail man of about 50, a little stooped, a little gray, with a short beard cut in a point, and a fair complexion delicately flushed with pink about his cheeks and ears. His blue eyes were warm and interested, even in reflection. They often had a kindling gleam as if his thoughts were pictures. Except for this lively and inquiring spirit in his glance, everything about him was modest and retiring. He was clearly not.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?